Hello and welcome to the Dyslexia Mom Boss Podcast, the show that helps you not only feel empowered and knowledgeable, but confident and a boss mom in the dyslexia journey. I'm your host, Dr. Lauren. So this is going to be a series on dysgraphia. Now, a while ago, I did two separate series on dyscalculia, as most say, which I'm starting to believe that is the correct way to say it. I think I've been saying it wrong. And then I also did a series on dyslexia. But I know that there really have been a lot of questions from parents and teachers, like, what is dysgraphia? What are the signs and symptoms? How do I help my child? How do I help my student? So this episode is really going to delve into what is dysgraphia, what are some basic signs and symptoms, and then I will delve into the various types. Now, I will preface this by saying that these are taken from Attitude Magazine. So if you are familiar with that magazine, you know, that is a credible place. So this article was last updated January 21st of 2023, and it was medically reviewed. So this is medical research. The article is a reflection of that. So this is not something that I am just pulling out of thin air or out of my ass. So I am giving you some information for those of you out there who are like, now I understand my kid has dyslexia, but I'm seeing some writing issues and I just don't know what to do. So first things first, what is dysgraphia? So this article outlines dysgraphia as a neurological disorder with written expression that impairs writing ability and fine motor skills. So I will do a separate episode on the signs and symptoms of the actual handwriting versus the actual writing. In my experience, I've worked more with students that have the written expression because most of my career has been working with middle school students. But I will definitely delve into that in separate episodes. But it can definitely have to do with the spelling, the writing process, the word spacing, the sizing, and the expression. So that's why it's really critical for teachers and parents to understand what these signs and symptoms look like, because your child could be displaying both. Or if your child is in first or second grade, you may only be seeing that written component with the fine motor skills, which then does impact that written expression because they're struggling and really putting all that energy into the fine motor skills. Now, obviously, we live in the age of technology. So with that being said, we might throw kids on the computer. I know my five-year-old takes computer class at her school, which is just mind-boggling to me, but it's the age of technology. So we need these kids to really have those skills. And I know that there are some occupational therapists that do believe that writing, you know, the actual pencil to paper is like a dead skill. And some truly believe that we can't have this be a dead skill because kids still need to learn how to write. So I know that that's a topic of discussion for another time. And I'd love to get an occupational therapist on the show to really give their thoughts around dysgraphia. So let's get back to some basic signs and symptoms. So again, this is a neurological learning difference, just like dyslexia. So when you think of dyslexia, most people think of reading and comprehension. When you think of dysgraphia, you think of writing. And like I said, it can be that fine motor or that written expression. So according to the National Center for Learning Disabilities, the symptoms of dysgraphia include the following: trouble forming letter shapes, that tight, awkward, or painful grip on a pencil, difficulty following a line or staying within the margins, trouble with sentence structure or following rules of grammar when writing, but not when speaking. So that's a big thing to kind of think about. Difficulty organizing or articulating thoughts on paper. And the last symptom that the National Center for Learning Disabilities states is pronounced difference between spoken and written understanding of a topic. And so those are, like I said, some overarching things you might be listening and saying, okay, my child has several of those. So what's next? And whether or not your child has been formally diagnosed or not, it's still important for you to educate yourself on what this looks like and what this means and how to move forward. That really is the whole purpose of this podcast, to really bring that education to light, where nobody wants to be walking, you know, a stab in the dark in hopes that they can understand their child's differences and needs. And so when you have a clearer picture of what you're looking for, then you can kind of piece that together in relation to what is more catered to your child's needs. Because as I always say, when you've met one dyslexic, you've met one dyslexic. Same thing with all of these other comorbid disabilities. There is a spectrum and there is a continuum of how mild to severe the child's learning difference is. So let's talk about what are some of the types of dysgraphia. Now, in finding research for this episode, there are some folks that will say, and I've seen this with dyslexia, where they'll say there are types. Well, I kind of disagree with that, because if you look at certain profiles of students where I have worked with dyslexic students where they don't have a lot of trouble with decoding. I mean, yes, decoding and that phonological processing is still an issue, but their bigger issue was the reading comprehension. So that's that oral language component, versus I've worked with severe dyslexics where it's a combination of both. So I don't believe that there aren't types. I think there absolutely are. And I think it's important to understand where that's coming from so you can hone in on that. Now, to get that diagnosed specifically, you know, to actually say dysgraphia is the primary disability and then here's the type, I'm not quite sure if that is something that neuropsychologists or diagnosticians can put on their reports. Maybe if they feel confident and comfortable enough that having that specificity will really get your child what they need. But I know from my experience working in public school, unfortunately, it seems like the more vague you are, the more accommodations you'll get. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the accommodations will really suit the needs of the child. So again, that is always another topic of discussion. But let's talk about the different types. So based on Attitude Magazine, again, this is reviewed by the medical board, and this is what they are saying. So there is such a thing as developmental dysgraphia. Now, I've seen this with dyscalculia and with dyslexia. And so this is referring to the difficulties in just acquiring the writing skills. So this type of dysgraphia is the most common in childhood. So the causes of this, research states, is unknown, but it has been identified that there are various types within that neurological mechanism. So the overarching type is the developmental dysgraphia. And so this could be diagnosed in elementary school in those early ages, and it might really reflect in the handwriting component more so than in the written expression. So let's take a look at a few other types here. Motor dysgraphia. So this is defined as a lack of fine motor coordination and visual perception, and this may explain the difficulties with producing written text. So really having those individuals work on that fine motor really helps. I know when I was working at one of my specialized private schools, I learned a lot from the occupational therapist that was assigned to the caseload of students in my classroom. And, you know, OTs do a lot, just like speech language pathologists. I don't think the average person really understands how wide that field is and how specific you can get, but really helping students basically retrain their brain to fix their illegible or slow handwriting. So you might see students with motor dysgraphia having illegible handwriting, or maybe it's taking them really long to write a word or a sentence. You know, depending on where they are developmentally, maybe their drawing doesn't look age appropriate. Their tracing skills might really be difficult for them to stay on that line. And slow finger tapping. So these are some things to really think about when we're thinking about motor dysgraphia. Hey, it's your favorite podcast host, Dr. Lauren. Have I told you how much I appreciate you as a listener? Well, if I haven't, I want to tell you just how much I do today. You're the reason I come back every week with top-notch content with guests to help you navigate this DQ journey. But I gotta tell you, organizing and getting these episodes up and running doesn't come cheap. I have a fantastic podcast team that takes care of me and you to ensure that episodes are high quality and show notes are detailed and riddled with goodies for you to use and apply for your next steps in this journey. But can I ask you a favor? We'd love to have your support to keep the podcast up and running. You can donate as little or as much as you'd like to support the podcast. All you need to do is go to the link in the show notes or visit our website at thinkdyslexia.me and click support the podcast, and it will take you exactly where you need to be. Oh, and one last thing. Don't forget to subscribe, comment, and of course, share this podcast with others who are on the same journey as you. I know that just like working with dyslexic students to retrain the brain and get those neurons firing in different ways, that's very similar with motor dysgraphia. When you work very closely with an occupational therapist, they are strengthening those fine motor muscles to really build up that stamina. And if you really think back, I remember being in sixth grade, and prior to that, we had to write in cursive. And that was just, I don't know. Some of you might really favor cursive. I know that there's some research that supports cursive is better for students with dyslexia because it's that smooth transition into just looping into letters rather than picking up the pencil and top to bottom and upstairs, downstairs letters. It's just like that smooth flow. But I know for me, when I got to middle school, we were allowed to write in pens, which I thought was cool. So any of you millennials who remember those jelly rolls, I used to use those all the time. And, you know, we didn't have to write in cursive. And I remember I had the biggest callus on my writing finger because of the pressure that I was putting to make sure that I was writing. And also we were just doing way more paper writing. You know, you're building up that stamina. Well, kids don't do that much anymore at all. And if they're writing, they're doing it on a Chromebook. So again, like I said, there are philosophical differences with some service providers who believe that kids still need to build up those muscles. And I think that if we notice that our children are struggling with that motor dysgraphia, we really need to hone in on that. Another point I want to really touch on with motor dysgraphia is students having trouble, not just with their pincer grip. And pincer grip, you know, that is really an early sign in pre-K where they're cutting things. So when we think about those developmental stages, when our kiddos are like, you know, 2 and 3, they're learning how to hold scissors. They're learning how to grip a pencil. And so if your child, the older they've gotten, really still struggles with cutting, that's definitely a sign as well. And they probably have some weak muscles that need some strengthening. So let's talk about spatial dysgraphia. So this is related to problems of spatial perception. So this can affect letter spacing and that drawing ability. So individuals with spatial dysgraphia struggle with handwriting, drawing, spelling, and again, that finger tapping speed that isn't as typical as their atypical peers. So I've seen students start, when I was teaching fourth grade, they would start writing like in the middle of the paper. So there was no concept that they would start at the left side, you know, if we're thinking about the, I don't know what the other line paper's called, but I know for the older kids, college ruled. So the one that has bigger spacing for the younger guys, there's a red line next to the 3 holes. It wouldn't dawn on them that they should start at that red line. So they would start in the middle of the page, or they would almost, if you were to take like 4 fingers and start it where the red line is, they would start like 4 fingers in. And then what was fascinating to see was, depending on how, you know, their perception was, they would go to the next line. Maybe they would skip three lines, and then maybe they would start closer to the red line on the next line, or maybe they'd go further in. So that's an indicator that there's some spatial dysgraphia happening there. And this is probably dysgraphia and dyslexia. But I remember when I would teach fourth grade, I had a chant because more than often my dyslexic students really didn't know their left and right. So I would get papers, you know, and this would be like spelling tests. I wouldn't have them write like essays or anything, but I would get papers where the holes would be on the right. And I would have to have the chant, the holes go on the left, the holes go on the left. And this was a song that whenever we would start our writing lessons, I'd always say, where do we start writing? And so, you know, by mid-year, students finally got it. And sometimes they would sing the song to themselves. But that is definitely an example of that spatial dysgraphia. And then the last one I really want to touch on, and this is more of what I've seen with our older students, our secondary students, is that linguistic dysgraphia. So this impacts the language processing skills required in the writing process. This most strongly affects that spontaneous written text, okay? And of course, that's copying, that oral spelling, and really getting those thoughts out. So let me put that into layman's terms for you. When kids get to middle school and high school and beyond, but I'm going to focus on middle school, there are many teachers that just assume that if they're talking and there are notes on the board, that kids know how to take notes. They assume that they'll say, okay, well, you know, here are the notes here and make sure you put this down because your notes are your study guide, which I completely disagree with that, especially with our students who have language-based learning differences. Like, you have to really scaffold that. But if you really think about the coordination it takes for a student to be sitting at a desk, depending on where they are, they may be in the back of the room. So they may not be able to see what's on the board, number one. And number two, while the teacher's talking, they have to take in that information. So that's that receptive language. They have to be able to express what they're receiving. And then they have to be able to have the skill set to know how to take notes. What does that even mean? They have to chunk whatever the teacher's saying. They have to write it down. So that right there is that expressive part. But then what makes it all the more challenging is if our students have some comorbid disabilities within dysgraphia. So let's say we have a student that has linguistic dysgraphia and motor dysgraphia. Well, now they're responsible for processing the information, chunking it in a way that makes sense, and then they have to write it down. I mean, that is ludicrous. And I've seen so many middle school teachers do this, and they get frustrated and they're like, well, look at this child's notes. They're awful. You know, like, how are they supposed to study from this? Well, first of all, we have to take a step back and look at what is the objective. If you have not directly and explicitly taught kids how to take notes, then that's on you. You can't assume that they're going to osmosisly know because they're in eighth grade how to take notes. And if you're goal as a teacher is to get them to learn to take notes, obviously you have to teach that. But then maybe you give them resources. So maybe you give them your slides if you have a PowerPoint presentation, and then maybe you let them know, I want you to find one bullet point on this slide that resonates with you and put it in your own words. Even then, that's still a lot. But I mean, that's really that higher level thinking to synthesize. But when we are really thinking about that linguistic dysgraphia, we have to look at that student's profile in regards to language. How are they receiving and how are they expressing? So I always give the example of whenever I would give directions, and if it was like, you know, basically leaving the kids to the wild, meaning they had to do independent work, I would take about 15 minutes to really delve into the directions. And I'm not talking about me talking at them. Like, this was an engaging discussion where I would give the directions. They would be written on the board and I would go through each of them individually. And then I would have students report back because it's so important to hear, are they understanding what I'm asking them to do? And then that always domino affected into another student saying, wait a second, but I thought you said blah, blah, blah. And then another student would say, no, she said this. So then that would cause a discussion, whether it was, okay, were my directions not clear? Or is it just one or two students who need me to pull them aside to re-explain in a way that makes sense for them? And so chunking that information is so important for the student to feel like they're heard and for the student to really feel like they're getting their needs met. So those are some of the types and some basic signs and symptoms that you can really kind of take in, let that sink in, you know, obviously do your research in terms of how this connects and relates to your child or some of the students, if you're a teacher listening to this, how this is really impacting your teaching, because we tend to forget that language really is a lot for most people. Even people who don't have language-based learning differences, communication styles, how we're really expressing ourselves, that takes a lot of nuance. And I just want everyone to really understand that when they're walking in to understanding these language-based learning differences. So that is all for this episode. Next episode, we will be diving into the signs and symptoms of written expression. So that literally is that linguistic dyslexia. What do the signs and symptoms look like? I'll delve a little bit more into that. So I look forward to seeing you in the next episode.